Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. George Washington is who we talk about this hour of the program, and we are going to learn so much about a president I think we don't know all that much about because he wasn't really forthcoming, and it's hard for us to understand him other than this wooden figure who was terribly heroic and the father of our country and laid a foundation for the way that presidents would govern this nation. But there is a lot to this man, and we're going to get to know him perhaps as his contemporaries did during the course of this hour. Our guest is the author of Washington, A Life, Ron Chernow, who covers Washington from cradle to grave. Ron is the prize-winning author of 5 previous books. His first, The House of Morgan, won the National Book Award. His 2 most recent other books, Alexander Hamilton and Titan, The Life of John D. Rockefeller, were both nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award. He says early on in the book that the goal of this biography is to create a fresh portrait of Washington that will make him real, credible, and charismatic in the same way that he was perceived by his contemporaries, by gleaning anecdotes and quotes from myriad sources, especially from hundreds of eyewitness accounts. He has tried to make him vivid and immediate rather than the lifeless waxwork he has become for many Americans, and thereby elucidate the secrets of his uncanny ability to lead a nation. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We always get many of them when we do these historical shows. So we welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you would like to use that, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Ron. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Kathleen.
You know, I was so interested in the cover and in your early remarks about Gilbert Stuart that I started yesterday going to the Internet looking up pictures of George Washington. And you start with a Gilbert Stuart story. Can you tell me why you did that?
I started with Gilbert Stuart. Well, for one thing, Gilbert Stuart was in the same business that I am. He was trying to penetrate the mystery of George Washington's personality. I also felt that, for better or for worse, the image of Washington that is fixed in the American imagination is Gilbert Stuart. It's rather unfortunate in certain ways because Washington by then was rather old and stiff and craggy. But I was also fascinated by Gilbert Stuart's comments on Washington because he said that he found behind that stoic and reserved facade that we know so well, there was a different personality hiding behind there. And he made the fascinating statement, had Washington been born in the forest, he would have been among the fiercest, among the savage tribes. He saw that tremendous force of personality that Washington kept under the famous cloak of reserve.
I was fascinated by the early life of Washington. I didn't know all that much about it, the relationship with his mother, the
right.
deaths of people who were
right.
important in his life. I mean, we may want to start with his mother because she didn't realize who she was raising. This guy was going to be the first president.
Washington.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Mother was something of a holy terror. Let me say, Kathleen, that it's significant because Washington's father dies when George is 11, leaving him to the tender mercies of Mary Bull Washington, who was a very crusty, difficult, domineering woman. We have no evidence that she attended the wedding of George and Martha Washington or ever visited them at Mount Vernon. We have no statement from the mother of the father of our country expressing any pride or pleasure in what her son did. In fact, she was constantly complaining that George was neglecting her. In fact, there was a very embarrassing episode for Washington late in the Revolutionary War. He was informed that his mother was in the Virginia state capitol at Richmond, and she'd filed a petition for emergency relief intimating that she had been abandoned by you-know-who.
Oh,
now, this
no.
was a very, very difficult matter. But I think it really shaped Washington in all sorts of ways, having to contend with this unusually difficult woman.
Yeah, and perhaps not unusually difficult, but a very difficult childhood with the deaths that took place, people who were very close to him, his brother Lawrence, and all of the illness that he had to contend with as well.
Right. You know, the most important sibling for Washington was an older half-brother named Lawrence, who died of tuberculosis at age 34. Washington's father was 49. And in fact, the males in the Washington line were notably short-lived. The fact that George Washington lived to 67 was very unusual. But by the time that he's 30 years old, he's had smallpox, he's had malaria, he's had dysentery. In fact, you know, in the 18th century, if you were able to survive all of these epidemics that were rampant, you probably had a pretty good shot of living to 70 or 80 years old, because you had to be a very hardy specimen. And obviously, there was an enormous amount of childhood mortality.
He looks like, and the image that we have of Washington is that he is a hardy specimen, that he's very tall, he's very rigid, his face is inscrutable. He is just the epitome of a strong guy.
Right, but you know, as I was saying before about Gilbert Stuart, since Stuart painted Washington when Washington was already showing extreme signs of age, in order to understand the charisma that Washington had for his contemporaries, I found that I had to go back to the earlier portraits by John Trumbull and Charles Wilson Peale. And there you see a different Washington. His face is smiling and expressive. He's graceful. He's lithe. You know, he was a great athlete. He was a terrific dancer. Jefferson said he was the best horseman of the age. He was kind of a man's man, and that this was given the fact that he was a soldier. No small part of his aura.
Mm-hmm. I was interested that you spent, and I can see why, it's such a large book and covers so much of his life. You spent 6 years writing this. I'm always interested how historians and journalists feel when they've spent 6 years so involved with this president's life. I mean, do you feel like you were just went way back into history and you were his neighbor, or what's that like?
Well, you know, with Washington, because Washington was a man of immense dignity and reserve, that even though I spent every day with him after 6 years and felt that I knew him intimately, you always feel with George Washington that there's a certain distance and detachment. I mean, for instance, if I had to have a beer with one of the founders in terms of wit, I would probably choose a Franklin, and in terms of intellect, probably choose a Hamilton. And George Washington was a mysterious character, Kathleen, but I found, because he was mysterious and also a very subtle and reserved personality, and hence difficult to capture on the page, this sort of drew me in. I like a challenge. I like the fact that this man was a very tough nut to crack, and it was particularly interesting to me that this was not only a man who had nine lives, but he was a very different personality in different settings of his life. And so to try to kind of draw them all together and to come up with a coherent portrait was a great challenge.
Yeah. Let's talk about the warrior part of him. I must say that I don't know and didn't know very much about the French expansion into the Ohio country and the fighting between the French and the Indian involvement and the British and George Washington's role in all of this. Isn't it interesting? And it really sets who he's going to be later in his life. But here's a guy who's really walking into what looks like probable death, either from disease or from being shot in all of this, and he survives. How does he get that assignment?
Well, you know, he was well connected. His older half brother Lawrence had married into the Fairfax family. The Fairfax family, the largest landowners in Virginia, they controlled 5 million acres between the Potomac and the Rappahannock River. And so by the time that George Washington is 21, he's entrusted, Kathleen, with a very important diplomatic mission of going to the so-called Ohio country. And this would be generally the area around Pittsburgh, southwestern Pennsylvania, West Virginia, eastern Ohio. He's assigned to go to the French commandant in the area and tell the French to vacate this area, which the French are competing with the British. And, you know, people don't realize, because they associate Washington with the Revolutionary War and with his first presidency, they didn't realize that he was a wunderkind. He was precocious. He not only spent 5.5 years in the French and Indian War, but by the age of 23, He is assigned by the royal governor to be the head of all of the armed forces in Virginia. So he's not the wise paragon yet of later years by a long shot. But what you find is he's utterly fearless, has tremendous self-confidence, and he already shows this unusual perseverance that if you give this young man an assignment, he will see to it no matter how rugged the conditions are, no matter how difficult. And that indeed does foreshadow things to come.
He's a little concerned. I found this fascinating about the pay that he's being given, about the disparity between how the British, what kinds of status they have and monetary status and what he has.
Well, this is a very good point to bring up because, you know, the young George Washington is not motivated really by idealism. You know, he's after money and status and power, and he's very resentful that he can't get a royal commission from the British. And what happens over the course of this lifetime, which is fascinating to watch, is that when the Stamp Act comes along, the Boston Tea Party, all of the preliminaries to the American Revolution, Washington takes all of these really personal grievances against the British, and he translates them into larger, you know, political ideals. And then, and he's in his 40s by then, he then seems to become, you know, this quite other figure during the Revolutionary War. But it starts out with his own personal bitterness and disappointment about issues like pay, which he's griping. He probably wrote more letters griping about, you know, pay and promotion in the army than anything else.
And he keeps a journal, a diary. Tell me this story. And then the French publish parts of this?
The French publish parts of it. Well, you know, Washington becomes, on the one hand, a heroic figure, you know, in Virginia, but a notorious figure in France because he inadvertently, well, his men, you know, inadvertently kill a man named Jumonville, who was a French diplomat on a mission to deliver an ultimatum to the British, so that Washington became, you know, quite notorious. But you're right; he kept an extensive diary of his the journey that he made to the French commandant. And one of the wonderful things about writing about George Washington is, though, although he was very secretive and mysterious about all sorts of things, he was a compulsive record keeper, and he was somebody who kept not only all of his letters, but journals and diaries. They're not, emotionally confessional kinds of things, but we have a tremendous record, and often I found those diaries were unintentionally very revealing about him.
Mm. How was he educated, Ron?
Well, you know, among the major founders, he's the only one who didn't go to a university. Madison went to what became Princeton. Hamilton went to what became Columbia. Adams went to Harvard, etc. George Washington, by the age of 15, is a surveyor. He was very, very self-conscious about his lack of education. He later on referred to his defective education. And so George Washington, because of that, is a strange combination. His early experiences that we were talking about out on the Western frontier leave him, you know, with an enormous feeling of self-reliance and self-confidence. But there's also an underlying anxiety that is no less significant in his life. And at every major appointment in his life, whether it's as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army or First President of the United States, he goes out of his way, in some of the same speech, he goes out of his way to say that he is unequal to the high honor that has just been thrust upon him. And I don't think that it was entirely false modesty, and it goes back to the fact that he didn't have a great deal of formal education and certainly no university education.
Yeah. What was the little book that he read? They're kind of funny now when we
The 110 Rules of Civility.
Right.
Because he was socially very ambitious. So he really wanted to enter the top rank of Virginia gentry. And so when he was in his teens, he copied out a book called 110 Rules of Civility. I'll give you my two favorites. So one is, do no man's face with your spittle by approaching too close to him. I don't know that one needed a book to discover that. The other rule that I loved was that it said, cleanse not your teeth with the tablecloth or a napkin or a knife and fork, but if you must do it in company, use a toothpick. So it's rather touching to think of him studying these rules. And actually, he did, the later on, the wife of the British ambassador was talking about what perfect manners George Washington had, but she was a very perceptive woman. And she said there was something so correct about his manners that they seemed a bit studied, and so she was on to something.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the teeth for a moment. You can't think of George Washington without the teeth. He just didn't have very many. What happened to his teeth?
Yeah, by the time he's president, he just has this one very lonely lower left bite cuspid, and he has a complete set of dentures, which are anchored on that poor tooth, and they were not made of wood. Obviously, wood would have rotted in anyone's mouth. They were made either of elephant or walrus ivory. What happened with the ivory as it aged and cracked and stained, it developed a grainy look. When people examined them 100 years later, it looked like wood. One significant discovery I made, because I did examine the dentures, is that his dentures were connected in the back by curved metal springs. What this meant was that every time he opened his mouth to speak, it would release the pressure on those springs in the back, and there was always the possibility that they would come flying out of his mouth. And, you know, and this is rather sad when you think of how self-conscious he must have been about that, because here, as president, he's constantly forced to speak in public. And so aside from the constant pain he would have felt from these dentures rubbing against his gums, there was the constant social fear that they would slip out of his mouth.
Where did you see his dentures?
I saw them at the New York Academy of Medicine library. In fact, there was a very funny and rather startling moment because I was examining them. The curator said to me, "Would you like to see that last tooth?" And I thought she was pulling my leg, you know, that lower left bicuspid.
Right.
And she brought it out. It turned out that it survived because when it fell out, which it was destined to do from the pressure, when that last tooth fell out, Washington gave it a sort of good luck charm to his dentist in New York, John Greenwood. Greenwood took the tooth, and he put it in this little glass locket, and he used to wear it on his watch chain. So he was George Washington's dentist walking around New York City with Washington's last tooth on his paunch.
What a story. That is absolutely amazing. Let's go back to idealism for a moment.
Sure.
Was there a point, when you talk about the recreations, the different Washingtons, was there a point, and was it during the Revolutionary War or when he became president, perhaps, when he was motivated by idealism?
Oh, absolutely. I'd say it starts around 1765 with the Stamp Act and then the Townsend duties. You know, by that point, he has a whole storehouse of personal grievances. He didn't get the Royal Commission from the British. They had blocked settlement out west when Washington was buying land there. He was very bitter toward his London agents, whom he felt sold his tobacco at inferior prices and then sold him shoddy goods in return at elevated prices. But so when, you know, the Stamp Act and the Townsend duties and the Boston Tea Party come along, Washington realizes that it's not just him, but that the deck is stacked against all of the colonists. And then he suddenly finds his political voice. And then we're no longer, you know, and he wrote many letters about this, we're no longer talking about his personal grievances. We're suddenly talking about the entire inequity of the subjugation of the colonists by the British crown. But I think that, you know, the underlying fuel, as it were, for that fire had come from these, you know, personal grievances earlier on.
Mm-hmm. It is, when you think about it, there are certain times in history that you wonder how the importance of an individual and how they got through this time. But you talk about what was going on with him when he was leading the army. No money, blankets, clothing, shoes, everybody's sick. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah, you know, in fact, I always say to people, if you don't believe that there's at least a grain of truth in the great man or great woman theory of history, read this book and tell me who else could have stepped into his shoes. There were other generals who, perhaps from a military standpoint, were superior, but this is, you know, arguably one of those cases in history where what's happening between battles is even more important, because we're fighting a war of attrition, and he has to keep together this, you know, bare, ragged army, which is suffering from these constant shortages. It wasn't just Valley Forge. I mean, the whole war was almost that bad. He had tremendous political gifts, because he not only has to inspire and maintain this army, but he's dealing with 14 masters. He has the Continental Congress, which is constantly interfering. He has to appease 13 state governors. So whatever his failings as a general, and I think that Washington was kind of a middling general at best. This isn't, you know, the biography of Napoleon. But as a politician, sheer genius.
Mm-hmm. At what point, and I'm wondering if maybe this even came when he was earlier during the French-Indian War, did he think that the British perhaps were not invincible?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a very important battle, 1755. Washington would have been 23 years old. He was the aide to Major General Edward Braddock, who came over from England to subdue the French and Indians. And Braddock was an old-fashioned, by-the-book military man, rather haughty, rather arrogant. And he used traditional European fighting methods, contrary to Washington's advice that the French and Indian had this much more kind of opportunistic, almost like guerrilla warfare tactics that they used in the forest. Braddock didn't listen. There was a famous disastrous defeat on the Monongahela River in southwestern Pennsylvania. And not only Washington, Benjamin Franklin made a very interesting statement afterwards, where he said that, you know, after that defeat, they suddenly realized that, in fact, the British military was not invincible. And because up until that point, it had seemed like the most powerful military machine in the world. And here the French, and then particularly the Indians, you know, managed by using tactics suited to New World conditions, managed to inflict this disastrous defeat on the British. So that was psychologically a turning point.
We have yet to talk about Martha and slavery and his presidency. There's just much more to Washington than perhaps we thought there was. Ron Chernow is our guest. He has written a wonderful biography of George Washington that was 6 years in the making. It is titled Washington, A Life. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ron Chernow, our guest. Our topic is George Washington. And let's go to phone calls, starting with Jake in Onalaska. Hi, Jake.
Hi. Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Ron. How are you this morning?
Fine. Everybody's good. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
My question was just this for Ron. Given that you do such deep research into the backgrounds of the Founding Fathers and the history of America, particularly at its founding, how do you feel about a lot of what's been, in my view, a lot of worship and idolization of these people who were obviously very great and did wonderful things, but you know, they're very complicated people, you know. The core fact of who they are is that they were people and they were flawed, and that
it's an excellent question, because I think that, you know, Americans tend to see the founding era as a golden age of politics. And there's kind of, you know, a good side and a bad side to that. On the one hand, I think that Americans get the founders right to the extent that these were philosopher kings. These people were, they were brilliant, they were fearless figures of tremendous erudition and integrity. And I can remember when I started my biography of Hamilton, it was my first book on the founding era, and I was curious, would they seem, you know, larger than, smaller than life? And they seemed much, much larger than life, much more extraordinary than I had even bargained for. On the other hand, I think that this idealization of the founding era can be quite off the mark to the extent that people imagine that there was something very genteel and civilized about that era politically, when it was an era of rather venomous partisan politics. And in fact, the founders, among their many talents, tremendous talent for polemics directed against each other. These were revolutionaries, so that they were very opinionated and very, you know, argumentative. They weren't these soft shoe characters at all, not these quaint figures that they're sometimes portrayed. But, you know, we had, think of this, in 1790, the U.S. Census was 3 million. That would be a little bit bigger than the population of Chicago.
Oh, my.
In a population the size of Chicago, we had a Washington, a Franklin, a Madison, a Jefferson, a Hamilton, an Adams, and a Jay, just for starters. Amazing.
It is amazing.
Amazing, yeah.
Yeah. Well, as long as we're on some of those, let's talk about them for a moment. Was he, I guess our image of him as well is that he was universally admired among all the people that you just mentioned. But I know that he had some thorny relationships, and you highlight them, with John Adams at times, with certainly Thomas Paine. What kind of esteem was he held in? What kind of esteem by his contemporaries who were involved
in
politics?
You know, George Washington was never immune from criticism. You know, early on in the Revolutionary War, he lost a number of major battles, and there were quite a number of other generals and congressmen who were jockeying to try to get rid of him. As president, he did have a honeymoon maybe the first year or two, but then he is criticized in an increasingly strident and partisan press, and he's accused of everything from, on the one hand, having been a British double agent during the war, to plotting to restore the monarchy. I mean, there was no charge that was too fantastic to be leveled at Washington. And so even though he was the father of the country, he was not, as time went on, a sacred figure in that way. You know, in terms of the other founders, it's interesting. He has better relations with the founders who were either a generation older, like Franklin, whom he venerated, or who were younger, like Hamilton, and for a time, Madison. More competitive relations with Adams. I think they were about 3 years apart. And the relationship with Jefferson that started out very close, they were about a dozen, Jefferson was about a dozen years younger, ends up very rocky. And then by the end, Washington is really not on speaking terms with Jefferson.
Ooh.
Yeah.
All right, we got to get to Martha here. You can't talk about George without Martha.
That's a good name.
how they met each other, the wealth that she brought to the marriage, and it also really gives us a much more human side, a house filled with children and slaves and the beloved Mount Vernon. How did they meet each other, and why did he choose her and she chose him?
Well, it was kind of a whirlwind courtship. Washington was en route to Williamsburg, the colonial capital, when he found out that, you know, a friend wanted to introduce him to this wealthy young widow, Martha, who was about, I think, 8 months older than he was, and she was probably the wealthiest widow in Virginia at the time. They very quickly became engaged. She brought two children to the marriage. And, you know, I don't think that it was the greatest romance of the 18th century, but it mellowed into a very, very deep and important friendship. Martha gave him financial security because she brought, you know, so much land, so many slaves. Washington was, you know, repressed in a lot of ways, and I think that Martha was an important confidant. Washington was constantly entertaining people. Martha was an extraordinary hostess, very skillful with people. And she was, you know, a woman of great integrity in her own right. And so I think that she really very much helps to, you know, create the stage on which George Washington ends up acting this rather grand life.
Hmm. And the question, which we still ask, why no children, and is it because there were no children that he and she had that he could more legitimately take the title of the father of the country?
Yeah, well, this is an interesting point, because Martha had four children in the previous marriage, two of whom had died in early childhood. The historical presumption, you know, then and now, was that Washington was sterile, although there could have been a problem in Martha's final pregnancy that made it impossible for her to have children with George. But we know that they tried. We know that it was a source of sadness for George Washington that he did not have children. But it actually ended up being a bonanza for his political career. One, there were a lot of religiously minded people who felt that God had deliberately denied Washington biological children so that he could be the father of the entire country. And then, perhaps even more significant, when he became the first president, and that there was a lot of fear of backsliding into a monarchy.
Right, yeah.
The fact that George Washington had no heirs reassured people that he would have no vested interest in restoring hereditary aristocracy.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, so it worked to his advantage.
Yeah. Matt in Lake Geneva, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering about Washington's role as a retired president in the Constitutional Convention to replace the Articles of Confederation. I understand that he was a somewhat reluctant supporter of overthrowing the Articles, and that he did so maybe under a misapprehension that stemmed out of Shays' rebellion up in Massachusetts.
The Constitutional Convention is before the presidency. It's in 1787. He becomes president in 1789. You're absolutely right that he and a lot of other people were reluctant to attend when it became clear that this convention was going to go beyond merely revising the Articles of Confederation, but would really scrap them and create a whole new constitution. You know, he was afraid of kind of risking his reputation again on something that was clearly full of political risks. He also, you know, Washington, because he was Honest George, he was a member of a society called the Society of the Cincinnati, which was meeting in Philadelphia at the same time in May 1787, had already refused their invitation to attend the meeting. And so he didn't see how he could attend the Constitutional Convention without the Society of Cincinnati, which was composed of his former military officers, without the latter feeling offended. But anyway, Jay worked on him, Hamilton worked on him, Henry Knox worked on him, a number of very, very persuasive people convinced him that his work as commander-in-chief during the Revolutionary War would be incomplete without going to the Constitutional Convention and making sure that the peace was handled as successfully as the war had been.
Let's talk about slavery for a moment. You say that he was oppressed by the issue for his life. The book has some fascinating information on his treatment of slaves, Virginia's, what was allowed in treatment of slaves, what they ate, what they wore. And I'd like for you to, well, let's start with why he was oppressed by this issue for his lifetime.
Well, you know, he's born in Virginia, 1732. He's born into a world where slavery is both commonplace and unquestioned. By the end of his life, in his will, he becomes the only founder to emancipate the slaves under his direct legal control. So this is a man who undergoes a tremendous transformation on the issue. I think really the turning point, during the Revolutionary War, he's surrounded by Lafayette and Hamilton and other idealistic young aides who are full of abolitionist fervor. And he then, you know, at that point in his life, he's opposed to slavery in theory. On the other hand, in practice, it's the basis of his fortune. And he keeps hoping that slavery will be legislated, you know, away at some point. This was a fantasy that he shared with all of the other founders, that in some, you know, future generation it would be peacefully legislated away. We know that things didn't exactly work out that way. But I try in the book to do a very, very searching look at Washington's behavior as a slaveholder, because he would feed and house them adequately. He took good medical care of them. On the other hand, he was zealous in tracking down fugitive slaves. And he could be a very hard master. I was very stunned to discover a series of diary entries where Washington is writing that it's the coldest winter on record in Virginia, and yet he's making sure that all of his slaves are out working in the field in weather so cold that he himself said it was too cold for him to go out riding.
Hmm.
Yeah, so he could be tough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he demanded his life up at the crack of dawn. His mother instilled some of that toughness in him of how you work every day and how hard you work and how meaningful your day is.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. He was a man with a tremendous work ethic, And it bothered him that the slaves were not very industrious. And he couldn't, this was a real blind spot. He couldn't seem to see, Kathleen, that the slaves would have no rational reason for working with maximum efficiency as slaves, because they didn't benefit. And, you know, so they did what slaves have done throughout history. You know, you're kind of passive-aggressive. You do enough to get through the day without being punished. But what's in it for you to be, you know, working your head off
all day?
And Washington really could not see how illogical his assumptions were in terms of what the slaves should do.
Don't you wish everybody had dealt with this issue much more thoroughly back in those days?
We did. You know, one thing that surprised me when I was working on Hamilton and first started delving into these issues is that, you know, we associate slavery as a controversial issue with the decades leading up to the Civil War, but it was no less controversial back in the founding era. In fact, James Madison said of the Constitutional Convention that the major fault line was not between the large states and the small states, which is the way it's always taught in school. He said it was really between the northern states and the southern states, and the issue really turned on the question of slavery. And so it was being debated, and the Constitution, there was in general a massive evasion of slavery. The word is never used, although the concept is referred to. But they didn't know what to do with it. You know, in Washington, because Washington was the figure of national unity and slavery was, you know, the most explosive and divisive issue, as a politician, Washington really ducked it. His courage in terms of emancipating his own slaves was done in his capacity as a private planter.
Mm-hmm. And what about, did he write about what he witnessed with black soldiers in the Continental Army?
Not in so many words, but it's an amazing story because at first Washington, as a major Virginia planter, is very reluctant to have blacks in the army. Particularly, you know, there was a proposal, there were several proposals during the war, to give freedom to any slave who would join the Continental Army. And this made Washington and other slaveholders very uncomfortable, the idea, you know, of arming the slaves. On the other hand, what happens is you see that there's tremendous growth in Washington during the war. You know, he endorses an all-black battalion from Rhode Island, for instance. It's very inspiring to think the estimate of people who've studied this closely now is that 5% of the Continental Army was made up of African Americans, which is really quite an extraordinary figure.
Yes, it is extraordinary.
Yeah.
More phone calls in a moment. Ron Chernow is our guest this hour, and we're learning about George Washington. He's written a very important and very thorough biography of Washington. It is titled Washington, A Life. We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. And you can also send an email. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's an email. Well, it's on Facebook. Peter writes, Ron Chernow eloquently reminds us of what Washington, our flawed and fully human founder in chief, hoped this experiment in self-government could become. I want us to continue striving to live up to the fondest ambitions that this hard-headed realist of an idealist harbored for our nation and our society.
I'm not sure what the question is, but, you know, I think that Washington, there are a lot of messages for today. Washington, I think like all the great presidents, he had a sense of American greatness. But I think it's important to stress it was not only a country that would be, you know, strong and prosperous, which of course we have become, but a country that would be honorable and just. And I think particularly at the moment, given what's going on in the country, we should all go back and read Washington's farewell address, because the farewell address, you know, followed 2 terms of very partisan warfare. It was a plea for national unity. He warned against the baneful effects of party. He said that when we disagree with each other most sharply, our discourse should be most benign and civilized, and really warned us against national disunity and political extremism. And I think that we don't know, obviously, all the details yet of what happened in Arizona, but I think that it's, message worth repeating at the moment.
Mm-hmm. He did his own hair. I always thought it was a wig.
Everyone does. Yeah. Yeah. That was very interesting, the hair, because the way that he would do it, okay, first he would fluff out the hair in those twin wings on either side. He then sprinkled powder on his hair. Uh-huh. And then, most importantly, he took the remaining hairs and pulled them back over his shoulder and then knotted them with a big black satin bow. Now, to us, it looks rather quaint, maybe even slightly feminine, but in the 18th century, that what we would call ponytail, what they then called a queue, was considered the manly military look. And so if someone looked at George Washington and saw that hair drawn back, you know, over his shoulder, they'd say, oh, there goes General.
Huh. Let's go to Jeff from Spring Green. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I've got a question about George Washington and his Freemason buddies.
Right.
50 of the 56 signers of the Constitution were Freemasons. Tea Party, Freemasons, all that. Paul Revere, you know, I always wondered why, but the reason they let Paul Revere go when he was caught was that he was a brother Freemason. So I was wondering if your book, I haven't read it, but if it talks anything about Freemasonry and the...
Yeah, I looked into it. I mean, it's a very interesting part of Washington's life. He joins a lodge in Virginia when he's 20. He joins a lodge in Fredericksburg. Then about 30 years later, he joins a lodge in Alexandria. When he became president, he was actually the Grand Master of that second lodge, and he's the only Grand Master of the Freemasons to actually be such while he was President of the United States, when he laid the cornerstone of the U.S. Capitol in September 1793. He put on the Mason's apron, and there were these ceremonies where he poured corn and wine and oil over the cornerstone of the U.S. Capitol. But what I discovered was that for Washington, I think when he first joined the Freemasons, I don't know, maybe he joined in the same spirit in which people of a later generation would join the Rotary Club. I think that it was very social. He made a lot of statements about Freemason, but he said Freemasonry. He said it was designed to promote human happiness and the common good. I don't think that there was any dark or conspiratorial dimension to it, but this was clearly something from a social standpoint that he enjoyed. And he believed in its ideals. And in fact, when he was buried, I think a number of Masons marched in the procession, as Washington himself had marched in funeral processions as a Mason.
You say in the book that he never, which is hard to imagine, because here's a man who becomes president, and the power of the word is, we think, always associated with the presidency, never conquered his terror of public speaking.
I know. You know, we tend to think of a politician now as somebody who's a spontaneous speaker who can get up and tell a few well-chosen, words or tell a funny story. And Washington, this is an important dimension of the book, Washington felt beleaguered by his own fame. Wherever he went, there was always a dinner or a ball or an assembly in his honor, and he was expected to speak. And so he felt under siege. And one of the things that I discovered in going through his diaries is that very often he would arrive in town early in order order to evade the welcoming committee of dignitaries, or he would sneak out of town early the next morning in order to evade them again. He was constantly craving privacy, but wherever he went, he had an electrifying effect on people. General George Washington was in town, and somebody who was more egotistical and perhaps somebody who was more spontaneous as a speaker might have welcomed all of this attention, whereas Washington felt very, very burdened by it, and his speeches tend to be quite short.
What about Martha? Did she like it?
No. Martha made a famous statement, you know, 6 months after she became the first lady. She wrote to her niece in Virginia. She said, "I feel more like the first state prisoner than anything else." And she said because she couldn't do go out and do what she wanted, she just stayed home. She was rather disgruntled. The government then moved to Philadelphia, which was more social, and I think that she enjoyed it a bit more. But this was, being first lady, was another of a long list of sacrifices that she made for her husband and her country.
Jeff, thanks for the call. G in Madison, hi.
Hello. I am of Indian origin, and I find this entire conversation and this veneration of the founding fathers to be very racially insensitive in a country which is almost 50% non-white.
Right.
That means 50% of the population today would be either second-class citizens or slaves during the founding days. And to venerate people who had slaves, who committed genocide against the Native Americans, who stole land, would be like asking a gypsy or a homosexual to venerate Adolf Hitler.
Right. Well, you know, I tried to, you know, deal in great detail with Washington and slavery and kind of treat the subject without fear and favor and ditto Washington and the Native Americans. I think that what we, you know, have to do as a country, and I don't, you know, far from glorifying this, it's kind of a very tough and a very critical look. But, you know, what I feel my responsibility as an historian is to get into all of the, you know, complexities and the contradictions. And this is a country that in many ways is, you know, stained by this, you know, original sin, but to try to explain how it happened. And also, as I pointed out with Washington, that this is a man who goes early in his career, you know, doesn't question slavery at all, but then by the end of his career, by the end of his life and his will, he not only frees all his slaves, he provides a fund to, you know, train and educate the younger slaves who will be freed. So what that says is very, very important, because there were people who were in favor of emancipation who then wanted to emancipate the slaves and send them back to Africa. The fact that Washington, you know, left money to train and educate the young slaves who would be freed meant that he did have a vision of a, you know, biracial society. And so you're absolutely right. I mean, slavery, who can, you know, defend it? It was utterly, you know, monstrous and reprehensible. But I think that we have to, you know, in fairness to Washington, see the tremendous growth. And in fact, he hoped, because his will was published after he died, he hoped that this was an example that would be emulated by other slave owners, and it wasn't. You know, had it been, you know, the example followed, not only would many, many slaves have received their freedom much earlier, but would have spared the entire country the trauma of the Civil War.
Mm, thanks for the call. He dies, is this fair to say, much as his father died?
No, they died of different causes. Washington went out riding in a snowstorm when he was 67, developed a bacterial infection, and then it led to epiglottis, the inflammation of epiglottitis, the inflammation of the epiglottis, the flexible cartilage at the entrance to the voice box. And it was a particularly gruesome way to die, because it meant that he had the sensation of choking and gagging. And then, you know, three doctors were called in to try to save him. At the time, the main way you treated patients was by bleeding them. So they drained him
five pints of blood, and they gave him enemas. I mean, kind of everything that they did, unfortunately, would only have hastened his death and made it much more gruesome. But he did show tremendous, personal dignity and poise on his deathbed as he had in life.
Mm. But didn't his father go out riding in the rain? And
that was similar. Yes, it does. Yes, you're absolutely right. See, you remember my book better than I do.
I read it more recently, perhaps. Well, you're just absolutely wonderful, and thank you so much for making him just so much more real and complicated and nuanced. It's quite a contribution to history.
And kind of mindful of what the last caller was saying. This is a book, Kathleen, where I don't sweep anything under the rug.
You know,
I feel that this is a great man, and a great figure can carry the weight of his flaws, and some of those flaws were quite significant.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ron.
Sure. Thank you, Kathleen. Bye-bye.
Bye. Ron Chernow, his book is Washington, A Life, which has just been published and is a wonderful book. It's published by Penguin Press. So that's it for our shows today. I hate to let go of him. I want to talk more about George Washington because he's worth it, huh? Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and for doing on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for all of your calls. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.